So if you want the truth, go to Dark City Radio.
Okay, good evening, Dark City. Right, I'm here, I'm Reese, and I'm here to talk a little bit about permaculture. So, if anyone caught me talking to Dawn a couple of weeks ago, some of the things we talked about were closed loop systems, multiple functions, and outputs serving inputs. So, following on from that one aspect, we're not going to go down the rabbit hole. We're going to go down the toilet bowl. I don't know if anyone else will find that funny. The kids thought it was funny anyway. And we're going to talk to Martin Doyle. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Norice. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Did you find that joke funny?
I did actually have a very a quiet snigger, but I have to say, because of the line of business that I'm in, I've probably heard all the toilet jokes going.
Yeah, I'll keep it to a minimum then.
Don't worry, they're all good.
Hello, Martin.
Hi, yeah, sorry. The line went a bit dead there, but I've got you back now, yeah.
Okay, so it's sort of termed humanure, is that, yeah, humanure, isn't it?
Humanure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's a few sort of systems that you can set up, aren't there, really? You run us through a few of those?
Yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, what I suppose I'm not exactly an expert in, but what I'm really interested in and the business that I'm in now is what we call compost toilets. And the end result of that is what's called humanure. In other words, it's human manure. Now, there are lots of different types of compost toilet. Some of them are quite large systems that, you know, you need quite not a lot of land, but they can be built outside the house, or they have all sorts of sort of gubbins underneath the house. So they require quite a lot of effort to put in. Others are just sort of like collection systems where basically you collect liquids and solids. And then they're composted outside. There's a whole variety of them. They start off with things like people may have heard of something called a tree bog. And this is where you sort of have a toilet that sits a few feet off the ground, and you plant trees such as things like willow and whatever around where the toilet is. So they basically soak up all the waste and goodness that's there in the ground. There's things like composting chambers, where you have like a couple of chambers where all the sort of solids go in there, and they're that you basically let them fill, and then you'd empty them out after a year. And then the sort of toilets that I specialize in, I suppose essentially they're buckets in a way. The specific aspect of them is that it separates the urine from the feces, so that it makes it a bit less smelly and so on and so forth. So yeah, there's lots of different types for all types of people, all types of different situations.
Yeah, and those are the ones that you do, Martin, are the type that you can sort of have in a home, aren't they, as opposed to, you know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about compost toilets is that most of them are completely waterless. So they're also known as dry toilets. So there's no flush. You know, the job of a compost toilet is to take liquid and solid human waste and create a resource out of it. In other words, taking something that shouldn't really be called a waste product, because it is a resource.
They're both massive, quite high in nutrients. Sorry, I was just going to say they're both quite high in nutrients, aren't they? I think urine is really high in nutrients, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I mean, just to sort of talk about the benefits of composting, or using sort of urine and feces. I've got a graph in front of me which was actually produced in New Scientist magazine, mm-hmm. and it's titled the Potential of Human Excretia. So, what a great subject this is we're talking about tonight. But it is because. What this graph basically looks at is the amount of nutrients needed to produce 250 kilograms of cereals. And it then looks at the various quantities excreted by one person in a year. And if you look at the nitrogen aspect, so this is the amount of nitrogen required to grow 250 kilograms of cereals. So the amount of nitrogen required is 5.5 kilograms of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Now, urine actually has about 4 kilograms of nitrogen. One person's urine every year has about 4 kilograms. And your feces has about half a kilogram. So together, they make up about 4.5 kilograms of the required 5.5 kilograms of the nitrogen to grow 250 kilograms of cereals. So that's a massive contribution. If you look at the phosphorus requirements of those cereals, they need about 0.8 of a kilogram for that amount of cereals. Urine has about 0.7 and feces about 0.1. So it's virtually there. And with potassium, you need just over a kilogram of potassium. And urine and feces together give you exactly a kilogram. Again, with urine giving you about 80% of the requirement and the feces making up the rest of it. So just in terms of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, using human excreta has you know, a phenomenal amount of goodness in there, which you can use, which obviously cuts down on things like the artificial fertilizers and all the rest of this stuff, which are made by all sorts of organizations, most of them not very nice, most of them very, very controlling, and I'm sure lots of the listeners know as well, a lot of it is made from natural gas, fossil fuel, and we all know where that comes from and all the problems associated with that. And, I'm sure I don't need to explain all of those issues. I'm sure everybody's sort of very well aware of those issues. That's the potential of it. It's got phenomenal potential for use as a fertilizer. But we have this sort of funny attitude towards it.
Strange, isn't it? It's like a Western phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a book which I'll probably mention a few times. If people are interested in actually learning more about this, one of the best books you can get hold of is a book called The Humanure Handbook. And it's written by an American guy called Joseph Jenkins. It's currently on its third edition. He self-publishes it. You can also read the book online free of charge if you go to his website, which is humanurehandbook.com. So that's humanurehandbook.com, and you can actually read the book online. You can also get it, obviously you can buy the paper copy, but he goes into phenomenal detail, but also he looks at the science behind composting, and he's worked with universities to study how pathogens degrade in compost, because the big thing, I use this word and he uses this word as well, people have this thing, fecophobia, it's like fear of poo. Yeah. Because of the way that we've been brought up as kids, we've got this big fear of it. And I can understand it, obviously it's smelly stuff and you don't want to be putting your hands in it and all the rest of it.
I've got three kids, Martin. I've had an unfortunate poo incident not long before the call.
Oh, lovely. I'm glad we're doing this over the internet, Norris. people have this and it is understandable and all the rest of it. And of course, you go back a few hundred years, and there was a lot of transmission of disease through unsanitary conditions. And obviously, the fact that people were chucking out, wee and poo in the streets and all the rest of it was a major contributory factor, both in terms of just general, bad sanitation and sort of, rats like human poo. So, wherever there are rats, you'll find there's fleas which can spread disease, and because they're attracted to the human poo, you have this rat problem, hence the disease problem. But also, if you are unwell yourself, if you've got a disease, if you've got pathogens in your body, they are going to come out in your feces. And so for a certain amount of time, if anybody else comes into contact with that, they've got the chance of picking that up. And that's one way that diseases can spread, particularly if that feces gets into drinking water. You often find this problem when there's been floods and the sewage mixes in with the water. What looks like quite clean water can contain all sorts of really nasty things. So there is the potential for feces and urine to carry diseases, and this is where I think part of the fear comes from. So this is why Joe Jenkins' book, The Humanoid Handbook, has been really, really good, because he studied composting, which is actually quite a new science. And you think composting is something that nature's done for, well, since time immemorial. But in terms of what we understand as composting now, as a science, it's only been really understood, I think, since the 1920s, 1930s. I might be wrong about that, but people have only really understood it and the benefits of it. But part of the benefit of composting human waste is that it does break down all the pathogens. I mean, most of the pathogens can't survive long in human waste once it's outside the body. They have a pretty rapid sort of die-off because the conditions just aren't right for them. But some will persist. And so if you're going to be and this is where people start getting a bit grossed out with the idea. If you are going to be putting poo on the soil, you've got to make sure that it's composted first, because that way there is no chance of any nasties, any bugs, anything like that getting into the soil, which obviously you're going to be eating stuff off. And so you have to compost it for a year at least. And the Humanoid Handbook goes into detail about how you can make sure that composting is done right to the correct temperature. And I'm sure, Norris, you know, you're a permaculture expert. You understand all about composting and so on and so forth. So it's a really important thing to do. But it renders the final product after a year really sweet smelling, just like compost that you'd buy from your garden center or that you'd make yourself in your compost bin in your garden. It doesn't resemble in any way what came out of your bum. and you know, it's sweet smelling and it's full of goodness and it's full of structure, really good structure. You know, all the good things that compost does in the garden from plant matter, you know, your human waste can be doing the same as well. It's excellent stuff. I've gone slightly off track now.
You was on roll, Martin, so I was just letting you go.
you may have to rein me back in from time to
no,
time.
I'm really
passionate about it.
You know? I think we're all like that, so that's fine. We just interrupt each other when necessary.
that's fine.
There's a couple of things that's come up in the text, Martin. One was about, like, are you actually vegetarian?
I'm actually vegan.
You're vegan, yes, I thought so. There's just a thing come up in the text about, because you touched on that, didn't you, with your talk I heard you at before, because it was for the Vegetarian and Vegan Society, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, obviously being no animal stuff.
Yeah. I mean, from the point of view of composting your bodily waste, there's no difference whether you're vegetarian, vegan, omnivore, or whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, it's all going to break down. You can on your compost pile, provided that you get your compost at the right temperature, so you get good hot composting. You can actually put animal feces, so dog and cat feces, and you can also, you know, compost anything, so like meat and products like that. You know, I feel a bit of a I don't know what the word is now, an anti-vegan talking about this, but you can compost anything you like. The reason most compost bin manufacturers say don't put meat on a compost bin is because most domestic compost bins don't get to the right temperatures. But if you're creating a lot of waste, and obviously if you're taking human excrement and so on and so forth, you will be creating quite a lot of waste, then they tend to get the right temperatures. And as I'll keep coming back to this book, The Humanoid Handbook does detail how to make sure your compost heap reaches the right temperatures, which will ensure really good decomposition of virtually anything. I mean, going back to your question about being vegetarian or vegan, if you're a sort of like an ethical vegan and you take it to its fullest extent, then obviously you would not want to be putting animal manures on your garden or on the land that you're growing things in, because, you know, you're a bit of a hypocrite, I feel, if you start taking animal manures on but you're not prepared to eat animals because somebody else is producing that manure for you. So if you use your own manure, then it is as good as cow manure, horse manure, pig manure, anything like that. You know, human manure, in fact, there is some diagrams in the Humanoid Handbook which actually talks about it. It is actually better in terms of its composition of nitrogen, potassium and phosphorus than other animal manures. So if you're vegan or vegetarian, I personally think using your own manure composted on your garden, on your plot, whatever, is sort of closing the whole cycle down, you know, because you're growing things on the ground, you're harvesting the plants, you're eating the plants, you're shitting the plants out, you're composting the plants down, which is creating a nutrient, and then you're putting that back on the soil, which then grows the plants, which you then eat. So, you know, permaculture is all about cycles. And if you break the cycle by you know, bringing in external things like fertilizers and so on and so forth, you know, it's not a complete cycle. Nature is all about cycles, and this is really what it's doing, is it's just bringing everything back into a cycle. But you know, you obviously don't have to be a vegetarian or vegan to do this. It's of interest to everybody, I think.
It sort of touches on locality, I suppose, doesn't it? Because, you know, the best things for that particular area are in the immediate environment. You know, they've got an immediate symbiotic relationship, it seems.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, again, if people are familiar, as you are, with permaculture, you'll know that one of the things with permaculture is to do with zones. So you have, like, you know, zone 7 is the wilderness, it's the outside, and you concentrate on the things that you need more often in, like, zone 0 or zone 0-0. So if you're doing, like, salad crops and things like that, they'd be by your back door. So is that zone 0, your back outside your back door?
Yes, exactly.
So you know, I don't know what you consider your bum to be. Is that zone 0-0-0? You know, it's like, it's a resource which is there. And you know, the problem, I mean, you know, why am I interested in compost toilets? There's a lot of things to do with compost toilets which I just think are really, really interesting, and both, well, from an environmental and from a personal responsibility point of view. If you use a compost toilet, you're not flushing a chain, you're not flushing stuff away. So there's several benefits to that. Big benefit is water use. Every time you flush the chain, you're flushing up to 8 liters of drinking quality water down the toilet and flushing it away somewhere. Now, in some parts of the world where they don't have good drinking quality water, in fact, you know, the drinking water just doesn't exist at all. It's criminal. You know, they would consider it to be absolutely criminal to be flushing away drinking water or pissing and shitting in your drinking water. So you're saving that drinking water. And also, there's one of the things that people don't think about is the amount of embodied energy in water. You turn a tap on and water appears. It's something we've just taken for granted. Fantastic. However, that water has to be pumped to you under pressure. You know, there's electricity required in the pumping machinery to get the water to you. There's also all electricity and chemicals required to actually cleanse the water and get it to drinking quality and so on and so forth. And then there's the other side of it, which is the sewage treatment side. Again, quite an energy intensive business, taking it all away, having to filter it, sort it out, and then putting it back into the water and hoping that all the nasty stuff has actually been taken out before it goes back into the river. And there's, you know, there's some questions about whether that's done efficiently or to the degree it should be.
Well, so I've got a figure as well. It's okay. I think this is from Patrick Whitefield's Earth Care Manual, and I think he says in here that 33% of the water we use is in our toilets.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is. It's an absolutely massive amount. And, you know, people can do a lot of things to save water. I mean, obvious things like reducing the flush on your toilet. There's things like, you know, there's the old saying that if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. You know, so in other words, you don't need to flush the toilet all the time. Yeah. It's people get really sort of hyped up about cleanliness and sanitation. Yes. And you don't need to go quite that far. So there's lots of things you can do to save water. I've got a friend who lives in London, and he's actually got a DIY rainwater harvesting system on his roof. So he harvests rainwater, which has been a big container on his roof, and he uses that rainwater to flush his toilet. He also has a compost toilet, so visitors to his house actually have the choice of the two loos. You know, whether if they're not comfortable using a compost toilet, and I completely understand that some people aren't. You know, that's fine. So water use is one of the big things to do with, you know, why I think they're a great idea.
Definitely. I mean, I'll just, if I can mention there as well, I wanted to sort of mention something that people can just go and do tomorrow. And I know, if people are aware of hippos, which are just plastic bags, really, that they can put in the cistern, which then reduces the water usage of the toilet. the water companies supply those usually free. If you phone them, they just send them to you. And you can actually, I think, use a bottle filled with water. They can be a little bit more difficult to manoeuvre in the system. But
yeah, or stick a brick in. Just put a brick in or a half brick.
There you go. So everyone can do that. You're pretty much right now, you know.
Something you can do. Yeah, definitely.
Another thing that came up on the text there, Martin, was, they were actually talking about Indian toilet paper, which is just basically a tap, isn't it, really? You know, I actually quite like, I've been to India, and I quite like that system myself personally. But, I mean, in terms of this country and people's attitudes, you can actually just put normal toilet paper.
Yeah, it all went quiet, but I can hear you now.
Oh, yes, it all went quiet over here as well. so did you catch what I said, Martin, about the toilet paper?
Yes, you're talking about the Indian toilet paper situation and that, yeah.
Well, yes, which I was just saying I quite like. But by the same token, obviously, attitudes in the West are slightly different for a lot of people. And you can just put ordinary toilet paper in a composting system, can't you? I mean, just... It'd probably be a benefit, wouldn't it?
It is actually, because it does actually add bulk and structure to it, because it's paper at the end of the day, so it actually forms a source of carbon in the final mix, because if you separate liquids and solids, and I can talk a little bit about sort of separating technologies and things like that in a moment, but if you separate liquids and solids, then the solids can tend to be a little bit nitrogen rich, so you do need to introduce a source of carbon, and toilet paper is an ideal source of carbon in that mix, so it will help with the final sort of composting at the end of the day.
I think particularly urine will take quite a bit of carbon, won't it, more so than...
Yes, indeed, most definitely. In fact, do you mind if I talk about the different sort of physical types of compost toilets? It's all gone very quiet.
You're all right. We keep losing. Are you back, Norice?
Yes, I'm here.
Good stuff. I was just about to say, Norice, is it okay if I just talk about the different types of compost toilets? People can go, no problem. There's two. If you're looking for something really, really simple, there's plenty of information. If you sort of Google compost toilets, there's plenty of information on the sort of larger toilets that require more building and so on and so forth. And there's some really expensive, very, very fancy toilets that you can buy, which have sort of separate chambers underneath. But in essence, they sort of fall into two categories. There's the category where everything, in other words, liquids and solids, go into one sort of container, either under or behind the toilet, and via some system, it has to try and sort of separate the two out. If you mix liquids and solids together, that's when things can start to smell quite badly. And one of the things about compost, certainly the compost toilet that I use and that I've got, is that it really doesn't smell. So the first sort of system is the sort of large system where everything goes in together, and you have some fancy stuff that deals with it all. You then got the really simple system, which is what the Human Urine Handbook talks about, which is essentially just a bucket. And so everything goes in the bucket. So you just, to make one, you basically create a wooden box with a toilet seat on, and the bucket goes underneath, and you sit on the toilet and you just do everything into the bucket. The key thing with that is that every time you go to the toilet, you must put in a handful of cover material. Now, the easiest and most relevant cover material is actually sawdust. And what the sawdust does is it acts as a cover which stops the smells coming out. It also starts the it binds. I can't really don't know all the technical terms, but it binds with something that's in there, and it really doesn't smell. You don't get sort of any smells coming out of it at all. And of course, the sawdust is a really good source of carbon. The upside of that is it's really simple, because it's basically a bucket, and that's that. The downside is that people using the toilet have to remember to put a handful of sawdust in. And based on feedback, in other words, you know, if it smells a bit, you might have to put more sawdust in. So there's a bit of interaction, a bit, you know, you have to sort of think a little bit more about using it. But it's essentially, it's really, really simple. And if people want to create a compost toilet tomorrow, that's what they need to do. A bucket, a toilet seat, box it in, and a bag of sawdust, and you've got yourself a composting system that, you know, is off the grid, uses no water, can be used virtually anywhere. When the bucket's full, and in the Human Manure Handbook, Joseph Jenkins say people say, you know, when do you know when you need to change the bucket? And he says, when you need to stand up to take a shit, that's when you need to change the bucket. But if you don't like words like this, don't read the book, because the book's full of those sorts of things. So when the bucket's full, you then transfer it out into compost heap, and you must use lots of cover material in compost heap as well. And again, straw from a straw bale is the ideal thing to use. So you must keep covering all the time, and that way you build the temperatures up really quickly. You give it excellent structure, and the contents will not smell. And then in a year's time, you have this really nice compost. So that's the simpler side, and that's the easiest way of getting started with a compost toilet. The loos that I specialise in, and the loos that I sell, are what are called urine separating toilets. So what that means is that the toilet bowl is actually divided into two parts. There's a front part and a back part, and it means that men and women have to sit down to use the toilet. And anatomically, when you sit down, the urine will always go to the front, and it's then basically siphoned off, and you can deal with it in some way, such as capture it in a container, which can then be used on the garden, watered down 8:1 as a fertilizer, or it could go into a soak away in the ground if you want. And then solids go into a bucket. And just like the sort of cheap, simple system I was mentioning earlier, when that's full, you basically empty that onto your compost pile. So if people want to create those, they're a little bit more expensive because you're having to buy this urine separating bowl, but they start from about £60 and go up to £600 for a fully functioning toilet, which looks like sort of similar to a typical home toilet, basically. They have a little fan in the back that draws air over the contents and takes it outside. And that does two things. It helps dry the contents out quicker, and it also takes away any smells. So in a domestic situation, you just go to the toilet, wipe your bum, toilet paper goes in the solid bucket, and that's it. You close the lid, walk away. So they're really, really simple. They're really, really simple to use.
And I remember where you spoke before, Martin, you were talking about some kind of, there's a lot of over-engineered systems out there, isn't there, that do amazing stuff.
There are. I mean, the science of actually dealing with human excrement has taken some really interesting twists and turns, and a lot of manufacturers have taken the complex approach to dealing with it rather than the simple approach. And I think it probably stems from people's desire not to be involved with what actually sort of goes on. Just basically want to go to the toilet and walk away. And again, I can understand that. But, you know, there are many systems, some of which involve heaters, which help to dry the solids out really quickly. So essentially what you're trying to do in those systems is you're trying to sort of desiccate the solids, in other words, extract all the moisture. Which makes it very dry, very quick, and hence it's quite inoffensive. It doesn't smell. It's not composted at that point, so you would add it to the compost pile. You'd have to introduce some moisture to get it to compost, but it makes it much more easy to handle if you sort of desiccate it and dry it out. But to me, it just seems a bit odd, and sort of goes against the grain, the fact that you're using lots of electricity to heat this and dry it out. Other systems have sort of like tumbler type systems where, again, they slowly tumble the contents, which will help the all the sort of liquids evaporate off quick, and so on and so forth. Others have grates that sort of move backwards and forwards to sift the contents and so on and so forth. But with all of these things, you just think, well, you know, if they break, somebody's got to go in there with their hands and sort it all out. So I'm of the mind that I think you should try and keep things as simple as possible. And that way there's much less to go wrong. And yes, it does mean in the case of a compost toilet like the ones that I sell, and this the simple one I've mentioned, if the toilet's in your house, you will be carrying, and let's not mince words, a bucket of shit through the house outside the compost heap, and that does worry some people. But, you know, put a lid on the bucket or use a compostable liner in the bucket, and it's not a bad experience. And, having used one of these for several months now and having emptied my bucket 3 times already, it's not smelly. I mean, you would imagine it would be, but it actually isn't smelly because it's like dog poo. You know, when a dog does a poo, yeah, it stinks. But once it's dried a little bit and it's got, you know, sorry to talk like this, but it's got a bit of a sort of dried crust on the outside, it doesn't smell. It only smells. It's like cow pats in the field. You know, they have a sort of dry crust on the top after a while, and they don't smell. They'll smell if you put your foot in it and you break that crust. Yeah, of course they will. But the contents of this sort of human urine bucket are going to be the same, undisturbed. They're not really going to smell too much. People imagine it's going to be really horrendous. It's not a pretty sight, but it doesn't smell. So it's not, you know, it's in people's heads. It's people's attitudes to this. And people think, you know, oh, God, this is like going back to the Dark Ages. You know, why would we have invested all of this money in sanitation and all the rest of it? And you're talking about going back to the Dark Ages. Well, you know, I say compostable, it's really are a modern twist on an old idea. The old idea worked. And let's, you know, I'm sorry to ramble. Please do interrupt me if I'm going on here. it's your show, Nuri, so I'm conscious of that.
No, I'm happy to listen to you, Martin. Please.
Thank you very much. So kind. Human excrement and urine was a really valuable commodity up until a couple hundred years ago. People were actually paid for their urine, and human excrement. Sorry,
I never knew that.
I mean, there's another book which, if people are interested, you should get hold of, which is called it's called Liquid Gold. It's by a lady called Carol Steinfeld, 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 I beg your pardon. It's called Liquid Gold. It's only a small book. It's about 5. It's published by Green Books, and it talks about the uses of human urine. And it's actually, I mean, some people are going to think I'm absolutely mad, which is fine. But it talks about, you know, how urine has been used through history. And some of the things that urine has been used for, it's been used in dyeing, as in dyeing clothes, to, you know, putting colour in clothes. And it's been used instead of, or as a substitute for something called alum, which is a dye fixer, or what's called a mordant. And what that does is it helps a dye to penetrate and actually stick to the fabric. So, you know, it's like if you dye a piece of cotton or a piece of wool, and you dye it using some plant material, for argument's sake, whilst the material will soak the colour up very quickly, it will also wash out quite quickly. So a mordant sort of like sticks the dye into the fabric, and urine has been used as a mordant for many, many years.
That's really interesting, Martin, because we're doing our explorations with nettles, and
there you go.
Use them as dyes. So
yeah. I mean, I've not done dyeing myself, but you know, there are people that have. There's also, I'm sure you've heard of the plant called the woad, Nuri.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, the woad was used for to get a particular colour of blue. It was a very popular colour going back a few hundred years, and what they used to do was they used to I think it's from the leaves of the plant, and I think it's the first year growth leaves. I might be wrong about that, but I think. Or is it the second year? I can't remember. Anyway, you could look it up and find out. But they used to make what are called woad balls, which we use in dyeing. And basically that's the woad leaves macerated a little bit and mixed in with urine. And so people used to be paid. In fact, there's some tales. I don't know whether these are folk tales or true tales, but there was tales about people used to stand outside pubs in the sort of late Middle Ages and pay people to piss in a bucket as they came out the pub because they wanted the urine, which used to go to the dye works. So it was used in dyeing. It was also used in the tanning process for leather. Sort of, oh dear, I'm a vegan talking about leather. I shouldn't do that, but it was. It's used in Scotland on woolen yarn to help. Woolen yarn used to be soaked in vats of urine before it was woven into tweed cloth. What else did it do? It can be used as a cleaner. it's some European countries, Germany and Switzerland, actually use the urine of young girls to help make some of their cheeses richer and more piquant. So there you are. So there's all sorts of uses for urine beyond the sort of use on the garden as a fertilizer. So you know, capturing urine is an interesting thing and has been done throughout history. And the same with feces, really. There was a program on TV a few years ago. I think it was called something like The Medieval Farm, or they did a series. They did one called Victorian Farm as well. And part of the episode actually showed people sort of getting up in the morning, going to their toilet, which was effectively a pit outside with a plank with a hole in it. And so when the pit was full of excrement, somebody then had to dig it out. But of course, it never went to waste. It went onto the fields and it went to grow vegetables and all sorts of things. And even today in parts of Asia, they put something on the fields, which is called night soil, which is basically untreated human excrement. Now, obviously, there are health risks with that. So in this country, we're a bit more aware of them, and we'd be very, very cautious about doing that because, you know, if somebody is ill, and as I mentioned earlier, if they've got pathogens in their body, it's going on the field as well, and you can pass things. You know, so it's a very valuable and very much used fertilizer. But in this country, as we've become very westernized, we've tended to sort of like, you know, shy away from these sorts of things. So yeah, there's all sorts of uses. One of the questions that I get asked quite a lot as well is people say, is it legal? You know, can you actually compost your own human waste from your household in your garden? You know, are the laws against it? And there is actually a directive from the Environment Agency, which basically says, provided the toilet is attached to a dwelling, not physically attached, but in other words, it's within the grounds of a dwelling for the people of that house to use, there's no problem in actually using both urine or, in fact, putting urine into the ground if you want to, and also composting human manure. And there, if anybody wants to find out a bit more about that, it actually, I've got details on my website. But my company, by the way, we're called The Little House Company, and our website is littlehouse.co. So it's littlehouse.co. And if you go into the, we've got a section called, I think it's FAQs, and in there it actually tells you what the legal position is in terms of doing all this on your own land. And basically there isn't a problem. The Environment Agency are quite happy because they don't consider it to be a major issue.
Excellent. I just wanted to mention as well a little bit about more sort of closing of loops with sort of the obtaining sawdust and straw. There's obviously kind of, if you have a little mooch around this place, you should be able to pick that sort of stuff up from, isn't there, Martin, without having to go out and buy it?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of sawdust, sawdust is the one of the most ideal cover materials. There are lots of other things you can use, and it depends what you've got available as to what's best for you. I've got a customer who uses wood ash, but I also have another colleague who is a bit of an expert on composting, and he says don't use wood ash because wood ash itself doesn't decompose and can cause the release of methane as the whole pile starts to decompose. So he says don't use wood ash, but this guy does because he's got a lot of it. You can also use things like leaf mold. So if you save your leaves and put them in a big wire container or a plastic bag, leave them for a year or so, you can use that as a cover material, although some gardeners might be going, no, that's a great thing. I want to use that on my garden as a soil conditioner. But you can also use that. You can use very fine wood chippings, not the thicker stuff, because it won't cover. If you're basically doing everything into a bucket, urine and feces together, don't use wood chips because there's too many gaps and basically smells and whatever will get out. But there's a whole range of things you can use, and hay, grass clippings are another thing that you can use. Basically, whatever you've got available, you know, to hand, try it and see. If it doesn't work, you'll know about it because it'll start to smell. But hopefully, it won't. And if you do need to buy stuff, then things like equine centres, horse suppliers, they tend to do, bales of straw, pretty cheap, a couple of years ago they were a couple of quid, but maybe 3 quid will get you a great big bale of straw. And they'll also do things like sawdust as well in great big bags. That's pretty inexpensive.
Oh, potash as well, Bob's right there.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's whatever you can get, your hands on. If you've got stuff around, then just use it and give it a go. Just don't be afraid to try, because the worst that can happen is it might smell a little bit, and if it starts to smell, then you just put a bit more on or try something different. Well, and away you go.
In actual fact, your nose does have a cutoff point, doesn't it, Martin? So you
don't
smell so long. It's going off on a tangent to beat, but and then your nose just basically goes, well, that's it.
Yeah, which is fine if you live by yourself, but obviously if you've got friends and visitors coming, then they start coming around going, "Yeah, God, Norris, you smell a bit of weed today, don't you?"
They're like, "I'm breaking down these Western stereotypes. People will have to deal with it, Martin."
I completely agree. You know, Go on. No, I was just saying, you're quite right in what you say. You do get used to the smells quite quickly, which is a good thing and a bad thing, because obviously ultimately you're not aware of it. Which if it does smell really bad, you do want to be aware of it.
Yeah, you do. You don't want to lose all your friends.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. I think we've got just under 20 minutes left, Martin. So I thought maybe if you want to talk just briefly about your shed, and then if people have got some questions after that before we
finish. Absolutely. Yeah, okay. My shed in the garden is my pride and joy. In 2006, I bought a small solar panel, just a 10-watt panel, and stuck it on the shed, and put a battery inside, and had a compact fluorescent bulb inside, and that, and it was great. You know, it was like independent from the electricity companies, and in the same way that compost toilets are independent from the water companies and the sewage companies. It was great, and I really enjoyed experimenting with solar and learning all about that, and seeing what you could do, and importantly, what you couldn't do as well, what its limitations were. Really enjoyed all of that, but I sort of ran out of ideas. It was like, well, you know, this is great, but you know, what else can I do with it? And I explored all sorts of things to do, and obviously these days you've got mobile phones and MP3 players, and I thought, well, I can charge those in my shed using free electricity, and that's great. But then as I started to get into compost toilets, I thought, well, you know, I can't just sell compost toilets for a living without having one myself. You've got to walk, you've got to walk your talk, sort of thing. I wasn't prepared to talk to customers and basically lie and say, oh yes, they don't smell, unless I'd actually got one that was in day-to-day use. So I built a compost toilet that went in my shed, and details are on the website that I mentioned earlier, littlehouse.co. If you go into the news section, there's actually like a blog which details that, and I've done a little video as well.
Details your toilet habits.
Well, yes. There's no pictures of anybody actually on the toilet, I have to say. So maybe some people would be a bit disappointed, but if they were, probably be shocked, if actually. So, I use the urine separating bowl that's about 60 quid. Bought a bucket which goes underneath, boxed it all in, and I actually drain the urine out, and it goes into a soakaway pit in front of the shed. So I dug a little pit a couple of foot deep, put some gravel in, put the pipe in. I do sometimes just wee into a container outside the back door, and that can go into a watering can with some extra water, and use that as a fertilizer around the garden. And I have to say, we've had some fantastic crops, flower crops, particularly in the last couple of years since we've been doing that. But in terms of the shed, I just basically wanted it to be able to drain away. I fitted a little 12-volt computer fan in the back of the box, which goes out through a drain pipe. So if you can imagine this box by the door, and out the back of the box is a hole. The drain pipe goes in, comes out the shed, turns 90 degrees, and just goes up into the air. And the computer fan runs off 12 volts. And, of course, I've got 12 volts in my shed through my solar panel, and the fan is running 24/7. So when you go to the toilets, it's actually quite a strange feeling, and people laugh about this, but you're sitting there on the toilet in the shed, and you have this sort of breeze blowing between your legs because the fan is drawing air over you, and it's not an entirely unpleasant experience, but it's a bit of a weird thing because you don't normally expect to have that. But that takes away all the smells, and in fact my wife, who was a little bit skeptical about the whole thing, actually commented that with the toilet in the shed actually smells better than it did before, because like any shed, it, you know, it's pretty musty most of the time because you don't use it much, whereas with the fan you've got this constant movement of air in the shed that it never had before, and so that the whole sort of musty shed smell is gone, and it just smells absolutely fine. And since put the toilet in my shed, apart from a couple of sort of emergencies and when it was really really heavily snowing, I've not used the indoor toilet for any poos. I've you know, used it for wheeze because you can't wait, sort of thing, but most of the stuff I've gone down the shed and used that, and it just works brilliantly, you know. I'm really enthusiastic about it because it's a simple technology and it just bloody works. It just, you know, and I wish more people would give it a go. I can't hear you, Nariz. I'm not sure if you can hear me or
hi Miles. We'll just have to wing it and prayer it.
Yeah, I don't know if that's you jumping in and out or me, I'm not sure.
No, it's you, Nariz, you're back now.
Is it me?
Yeah, carry on, you're back now, we only missed a few seconds.
Okay, sorry, carry on then, Martin.
Yeah, basically that's my shed. As I said, I've got a solar panel on the outside, I've got battery, I've got lots of other things in the shed, which I just love experimenting with solar stuff because it's off-grid and because, you know, it's giving you the ability to function with electricity away from the energy companies, which I think is could be a very important thing in the future. So, you know, if for argument's sake the electricity supply gets hit, I'm not saying this would happen or could happen or anything, I'm just what ifs are in the air. But, you know, I've got a shed where I've got a battery, and I've got light in the shed, and I've got a toilet in the shed. So whereas other people would be struggling for light, and if the water went as well, they'd be struggling to flush the chain and all the rest of it, at least we'd be able to go to the toilet safely and in a hygienic manner, wouldn't be spreading sort of stuff around the streets and all the rest of it. So I've got that degree of independence, and it's just, you know, I love it. I just think it's really, really interesting area to build up that independence. You know, not completely sort of like independent from everybody, but just to be able to know that I'm independent from certain organizations, I think is, for me, it's a really important thing and a big step forward.
I'd agree with you. I think it's brilliant. Well, I haven't actually looked at your website yet. I haven't, but just listening to your story, I've never done anything on these lines of toilets that you're talking of.
Yeah,
I've done quite a lot in composting.
Yeah.
And closed loop systems and so forth, and using worms really.
Yeah.
To just simple garden worms to break down the system.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Great,
yeah.
Great information, Martin. Absolutely brilliant information.
Thank you. Thanks. It's a really, I mean, as I said, I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I'm really enthusiastic about it because it's just a really, really simple system that works incredibly well. If you're worried about it, if you've got any sort of concerns about, you know, using human waste, then certainly by all means have separate human compost heap piles. The rule of thumb is, generally speaking, you need to compost this stuff for a year, at least a year. Some people compost it longer than that. That way you can be absolutely sure that all the pathogens, anything that could cause any problems, is completely broken down. And what you end up with is a beautiful, beautiful compost that, you know, has got a lovely structure, a lovely smell. So if you've got a couple of compost bins, the way to work it is when you empty your compost toilet onto the bin, assuming that you're using a bucket-based system, stick it in the bin, add some other carbon-based stuff, so some straw, some paper, whatever, basically, and just keep piling that up until the bin is about full. When the bin's full, cap it, and basically leave that to sit for a year. Then you can start on your second bin. And with two bins on a yearly basis, you can just rotate them and cycle them around. And then you've got some terrific compost. You know, you've got all this nutrient available, which enable you to grow more stuff. It's a great system, and it's not complicated. You know, you can have fancy compost toilets if you want them. And you can have them that look just like ordinary toilets and all the rest of it. But if you want a really simple system, you can have that as well. And, you know, go out and try it, because, you know, just give it a go. And you have a toilet anywhere. That's the key thing, because, you know, you don't need to be by water supply or a sewage supply. You can have a toilet in the middle of nowhere, and they work. They're really good.
Martin, do you know anything about water rates? Did you get a reduction in your water rates if you stopped using a main
stream? No, you don't. Your water rates are generally fixed unless you're on a water meter.
Yeah.
With your water rates, I mean, again, I don't know. I can't speak for everybody across the country, but where I am, we're not on a water meter, and we just pay certain rates, and that's that. If we were to only have a compost toilet,
you could challenge.
Yeah. I mean, if you're on a water meter, then every time you flush, I think I don't. Absolutely quote me on this, but I think somebody said it's something like 3.5 pence worth of water per flush, assuming you do like an 8-litre flush. So every flush is about 3.5 pence. So, you know, if you consider, if there is a family of four, you know, you could work out, I'll just grab a calculator or so. So let's say there's four people in the family, and I mean, how many times a day would people go to the toilet? I suppose, assuming sort of having a wee, maybe sort of like five times a person. Is that reasonable to say, do you think?
So let's say
there's four people and going to the loo five times a day. So that's 20 flushes. Assuming that was 3.5 pence a flush, that's 70 pence a day you're paying to sort of flush your loo. So, you know, it's not a great amount of money if I've added it up right, but, you know, you multiply that by seven, that's £4 to £5 a week. So multiply that by four, that's £20 a month. Multiply that by 12, that's £235 a year. That actually sounds a little bit high to me. That might be wrong, but my maths isn't very good. But you can see there how you can actually save money, basically, if you were on a water meter and had a compost loo. It could save you money, because you're not paying for water to flush down the toilet. Can't hear you, Nerys. I wonder if you've gone again.
Martin, there's another point actually about water as well, and that is that everything that gets flushed has to get treated.
Yes.
And so even if you don't care about throwing away sixpence a flush, maybe of that flush you don't worry about that, but do worry about the fact that all of that is going to get treated, and that's going to put a whole lot more chemicals back into the water supply, and it means that next time you turn on the tap, you're going to be drinking even more chemicals than you started off with. So, you know, it's not just pounds and pence that matter.
Yeah,
really.
Absolutely. I mean, to me personally, the financial aspect has got nothing to do with it whatsoever. I'm not doing this for many reasons. I'm doing it because I think it's the right thing to do. It's a good thing to do. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there is another program to be talked about there in terms of what actually goes into the water, in terms of chemicals, in terms of pharmaceutical drugs that people are taking as well. And there are questions being asked about whether those are adequately treated in sewage plants. In other words, how much of the pharmaceuticals and drugs that people are taking is actually getting back into the rivers, which are then acting, or rivers and lakes, which are then the source for drinking water. So, you know, there's all sorts of questions and queries there. So the less that you can flush out into that system, the better, most definitely.
Yeah, we thought so. And the other thing is, you know, people feeling a bit queasy with dealing with all this shit. You know, in India, everywhere you go, it's very difficult to find a toilet like you'll find one in the West. Almost always a squat toilets, which is a much healthier way to clean yourself, really, and they have a jug of water, and this, you know, it means that you end up with a lovely clean bum, Indians look on Westerners as crazy people with dirty bums. They smear it all with paper, and none of that's necessary. And people, if they feel squeamish about it, just think about the fact they do clean their bum. I hope when they have a bath and a shower and things, you know. Yes. Well, actually, it's nice to clean your bum straight away after you've had a shit. Yeah. Really.
They clean all the time, this is a thing.
And all the disgust and so on, that's a head thing, that's a cultural thing. It's another thing where they've twisted your mind and got you away from your nature, how you naturally are. And you end up feeling a lot cleaner and fresher and everything lovely. Mm-hmm. People, because their culture has taken them away from all these things that are completely natural to them, and it's very good to get back in touch with yourself. Do you feel that you have done that a lot more as well, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. The hardest part, the most difficult thing that I have in you know my business is actually convincing people to make this move. It is culturally, it's entirely a culturally thing, because we have been conditioned that you know, it's nasty, it's horrible, you have to flush it all away, and all the rest of it. And in fact, it is entirely natural. You know. We seem to be very happy to buy a bag of cow manure or horse manure and put that on our garden. But, you know, what about your own manure? I mean, really, what is the difference? Provided you can get away from, understand the disease and pathogen issues, and provided they're all safe, and, you know, what's the difference? There is no difference. And we do need to understand it and connect with it more. And it is, you know, it sounds an odd thing to say, but it's actually a very satisfying thing to use a composting toilet, because, you know, I've often said to people, and I mean this, you know, I sit there with a sort of smug grin on my face thinking, you know, I'm not about to flush 8 litres of drinking water down into a sewage system. You know, I'm creating, it's not a waste that's coming out of my bum, it's a resource that's coming out of it, and I'm using it. So I'm quite passionate about it, definitely.
Yeah, well, it sounds like we are too. And I noticed in the chat, Vosto was saying, do you know, in Romania, it's normal to go and shit out in the garden. And in India also, they shit directly on the fields. And one of the things that this means is that some vitamins, B vitamins that we produce really late in our digestive system, too late to take advantage of them, those B vitamins get flushed out of us as well, and they get on the fields and back into the culture. So we're provided with something that gives us some independence from animals, which is the other place that people get B vitamins from.
Yes.
So it's important.
Yep.
From that respect also.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Can I say this has been a brilliant show? I've really enjoyed listening to you, Martin.
Thank you.
I know the ins and outs of composting.
Mainly the outs, not so much the ins. It's all the outs. That's the
thing. The outs and the outs.
The ins come from the gardening and stuff.
Absolutely.
That follows.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for having me on.
Isn't
that? Yeah, thanks, Martin. Yeah.
No problem at all.
What a cracking show, Nari's.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Even for all your technical difficulties. I don't know who's producing tonight, but there's 1 minute left if they're listening.
Yeah, well, I'll very quickly say I've been talking to a few other people, lining people up to come on. And Patrick Whitefield, he's said he'll come on from Raglan's Lane Farm. So I'm really chuffed about that. He's a very knowledgeable man. And also Bridget Strawbridge, lovely lady who knows everything there is to know about bee nation and neonicotinoids, all that kind of thing. And I have, who I was talking to, the couple of girls from Southampton Permaculture Network, Helen and Claire, who are going to come on and talk about transition towns and low carbon. So, yeah. Got some good people with plenty to talk about.
Things, yes, lots and lots of different things. There's chat, there's music, diversity, an occasional argument, you know, for the warmongers.